Twain published The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn in December 1884. 4 months later, the library in Concord, Massachusetts banned it. 134 years later, it is still the 14th most banned book, according to the American Library Association. At the same time, supporters of the novel argue that it's one of the great American novels. Xavier University Professor Emeritus John Getz will be leading a discussion beginning at 7 tonight on and about The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn at the Harriet Beecher Stowe House on Gilbert Avenue, 2950 Gilbert Avenue in Walnut Hills. The discussion series is free and open to the public. Joining Professor Getz this afternoon is the president of the Harriet Beecher Stowe House Friends, Chris DeSimio, who was on with us the first part of the show, and also Christina Hartlieb, who is the executive director of the Stowe House. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
Pardon me.
It's always a pleasure. It seems like I was just here.
You were just here.
Yeah. You're the indispensable man. So anyway, John, let's begin by focusing on the book. What were the objections to the book in that last part of the 19th century when it first came out, in the 1880s when it first came out? Because I suspect what's being objected to today is different.
That's true. It's been controversial from the time that it came out. Initially, people were expecting it to be a different kind of book because there was this tradition of the bad boy book, as it was known at the time, starting in 1870 with Thomas Bailey Aldrich's Story of a Bad Boy. But these weren't really bad boys at all. They were just kind of mischievous, got into a little bit of trouble. And then by the end of the book, they were rehabilitated and happily integrated into society. Well, that doesn't happen in Huckleberry Finn. And those books affirmed the values of the society that they were presenting. Well, Huckleberry Finn bitterly skewers the slaveholding society of the pre-Civil War South, and Huck is, by the standards of that society, a bad boy right to the end.
Well, is the fact that Mark Twain published Tom Sawyer 8 years before and was very popular and seen as a boy's book, and then he comes out with this, which the language, the relationships between whites and blacks really challenge the society of the third quarter of the 19th century.
Yeah, it's a very different kind of book. And you have to remember, too, as Chris was saying before, that the time in which it comes out, 1884, that was post-Reconstruction. And it was a time when there was a real reaction against Reconstruction in the South. And what we call the lost cause was being glamorized at this time, being developed. The South was trying to win the war of words in the North. In fact, there's a quote by one of those, Thomas Nelson Page, one of the writers of The Lost Cause, who argued in 1892, well after this book was published, that in fact, the South lost the war because of Harriet Beecher Stowe. Her power, the power of the language, was able to mobilize people against slavery so much, the South didn't have any voice like that. So this lost cause is a belated attempt to try to revive the, not to win the war on the field, but to win the war of words and glamorize the old South.
At the end of Reconstruction, and that's when all of these statues were erected in the last part of the 19th, early part of the 20th century.
Exactly, yeah.
Not immediately after the Civil War. From the perspective of this happening, this discussion happening at the Stowe House, Christina, why is it important for the Stowe House to sponsor this discussion?
Well, Harriet Beecher Stowe really was someone whose words changed the world. And her ideas and things that she talked about in 1852 with the publication of Uncle Tom's Cabin really set up the stage in terms of Northerners were now willing to think about slavery and think about the evils of slavery. And they weren't necessarily thinking about that prior to the publication of Uncle Tom's Cabin. So the ideas and words changing the way people think is one of the things that we promote with all of our programming and our educational activities. So that plays into and the idea that, you know, Harriet Beecher Stowe and Mark Twain were friends later in life. They lived right next door to each other in Hartford, Connecticut.
And
so,
and that's one of the things, Chris, if you go to the Harriet Beecher Stowe Center in Hartford, and it's like, oh, right next door, that was Mark Twain's house. It's like, wait a minute, how did that happen?
Yeah, you can just imagine the conversations they must have had. When Harriet lived here in Cincinnati for 18 years, she was broke and sick a lot. Six of her seven kids were born here in Walnut Hills. One of them died in Walnut Hills and was buried in Walnut Hills. He's now probably in Spring Grove in an unmarked grave, remarkably. But when she wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, suddenly she – when it was published first in, as a newspaper serial in 1851, then in 1852, she got a book deal. Suddenly she wasn't poor little Harriet anymore. She was rich. And after leaving Andover College, where by then her husband, Calvin, had been teaching, they moved to – they built this house in Hartford and then another house in Hartford, which is what's now known as the Harriet Beecher Stowe Center. They've done a great job restoring it. But to imagine living right next door to one of the most famous men in America and certainly one of the most beloved, it's interesting when you think about how Uncle Tom, who really is a heroic Christ figure of a character in the book, suddenly is brought back with his little pal Huck Finn to realize that he was going to New Orleans. They were going down that river, that same river that Uncle Tom dove into to save little Evangeline. That they both did the same kind of thing. They turned it on its head. So Harriet made people realize that it wasn't just a black and white issue, that the bad guy, Simon Legree, was a Yankee. He was a Northerner based on a real character her brother Charles had run into collecting as a bill collector in New Orleans. And then Huck Finn taking, you know, escaping with Jim the slave from Missouri. Because remember, people thought, oh, Missouri, they were in the Union in the Civil War. Well, they were a slave state throughout the Civil War too. So it's playing on those relationships that people had assumed were all binary, and they're not. That she showed it wasn't just black and white. There are several shades of gray in between, and that's what both these books explore.
John, to what extent – I mean, what Chris is talking about is the role of Harriet Beecher Stowe in the creation of Uncle Tom's Cabin and the influence that had. What do we know about Mark Twain and his interactions? Yes, they live next door, but from a literary point of view – did they talk about literature? Did they work, sort of play off of each other in a conscious sort of way?
Well, it wasn't just Stowe and Twain either in Nook Farm, that area in Connecticut. It was a little artist's community, really. And they all, Twain said, we never locked our doors. People were kind of in and out of each other's houses. So I think they talked about all sorts of things, what they were writing. There's a moment, well, Twain wrote The Prince and the Pauper, and then Stowe and he talked about it somewhat later, and she said, this is the best book that's written, ever been written for young folks. And so they were well aware of what each other was doing. There's a funny story about Twain dropping in on Stowe one day and just paying a social call. He went home, and his wife got on his case because he didn't have his proper tie and collar on. So he sent his collar and tie over to Stowe's house, and Stowe thought it was a great joke and wrote back and said, I see that Mr. Clemens has learned to do social calls on the installment plan. So they played tricks on each other.
And Mark Twain is Samuel Clemens.
Yes.
That's his real name. He's writing under Mark Twain. So what are the objections on an ongoing basis today? Why is this book still controversial?
Well, it's controversial because of partly the language, the use of the N-word, and also because of the characterization of Jim. And what do we make of that character? Is he, as those who don't like the book say, he's a kind of reduced to a minstrel show character, particularly in the later chapters of the book, the evasion chapters, as they're called. And yet other people who say, the defenders of the book, and there's a really interesting book called the problem of Jim that takes the defense of Twain on this character, saying Twain was smart enough to understand that the face that a slave could show to white people, whether they were his owners or not, was not necessarily who he really was. So Jim always has to be very careful in dealing with Huck, even though he doesn't know how far he can trust Huck, but he has to be very careful in dealing with anybody. And we need to remember also that the narrator of the book is not Twain. He was the narrator of Tom Sawyer, but Huck Finn, about a 14-year-old kid, is the narrator of this book. And he sees some things pretty clearly, but other things, he's a creature of his time and inherits a lot of the prejudices of his time.
And do you think that Twain was making that the case? I mean, because he was a 14-year-old narrator, he was purposely making sure that what he shared was just reflecting the attitudes at the moment?
I think so, because Huck, in the profound moment in the book, probably the most quoted moment, when he says, "I'll go to hell, all right, then I'll go to hell," rather than turn Jim in. He's written a letter turning Jim in, and he says, "I can't do it." But he thinks he's going to go to hell for that. He's violating all of the norms of his society. And so I think clearly Twain doesn't think Huck's going to go to hell for this. So I think that's a good point to open out from in the rest of the book and say, where do we second guess Huck? Where is he just a creature of his time?
Huck also worries that he's just going to be seen as a low-down abolitionist.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting because abolitionism has become, having just spent a year at the Freedom Center where we spend a lot of time raising abolitionists up, we forget how they were seen, especially in the South prior to the Civil War.
It's a dirty word.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, they were out to undermine the society. So, Christina, what do you hope people coming to the Stowe House in Walnut Hills, and I think that there's a lot of people who have never been there.
There are.
And what do you hope that they begin to come to grips with by coming to an event like this tonight, this discussion,
right,
or other visits?
Right. Well, I see events like this, and you know, we have a whole slew of programming that's similar to this and different than this in terms of different ways to bring people into the Harriet Beecher Stowe House. But really, the ultimate goal is for them to see, it's a window for them to see what's going on. What are we doing here at the Beecher Stowe House? And there's lots of things that are going on right now in terms of, you know, our lecture series and our Visiting Uncle Tom's Cabin with Stowe and Friends series and our, our semicolon book club as well, in addition to other big events like Harriet's birthday party.
The semicolon referring back to a literary society that Harriet belonged to
when she lived here, yes. So it takes its name from that, but it's about contemporary books that we look at and discuss and so forth. So there's all of these different events that are going on in terms of bringing people to the house and seeing the things that we do. And the things that we do really is tell the story of abolition in Cincinnati. The Lane Seminary debates were the first abolitionist debates in 1834 in the United States. And that was happening right next door at the Lane Seminary. The Beecher Stowe House is the only building left standing from the Lane Seminary. So we've got that we're bringing people in. We also tell them the stories of, you know, abolitionism in the Underground Railroad. We tell the story of how Harriet, living in Cincinnati, was able to write an anti-slavery book. Had she stayed in New England and lived there, she would not have learned the things that she needed to learn to be able to write that. And then we also tie that into the 20th century history of the house, which has a whole nother life after the Beechers leave. And in fact, was, you know, as part of the Walnut Hills community and this house standing in Walnut Hills, which is a vibrant African-American business district in the 1920s and 30s and 40s. And it was listed in the Negro Green Motorist book as a tavern. And so all of these different stories and bringing the ideas of abolition into the 20th century, and then we'd like to bring that whole story into the 21st century.
Chris, we've talked about Mark Twain, Harriet Beecher Stowe, there's a third giant here that, and it's Frederick Douglass. And we're in the 200th anniversary of 200th anniversary of Douglass's birth. What relationship do we know about Douglass and his relationship to Mark Twain or his relationship to Harriet Beecher Stowe?
I'm not so sure about the relationship with Mark Twain. Perhaps Dr. Goetz would
speak on that.
But his relationship with Harriet was quite close. While she was writing the book, she actually wrote to Frederick Douglass, who had already become very famous, having been brought and thrust into the spotlight by William Lloyd Garrison in the 1830s. So she writes to him asking for some confirmation of, is this true? Is this right? She was just checking some of her notes. But the other thing is that Frederick Douglass and William Lloyd Garrison were feuding at the time. And there's a direct link to Cincinnati, at least the evidence, the fingerprints of this are in Cincinnati, because there were anti-slavery meetings, conventions. The Female Abolition Society, Western Women's Abolition, I can't remember the exact name, but two conventions were held in Cincinnati after the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. And because they were feuding so violently, because Douglass started his own newspaper— and kind of left mentorship of Garrison, they wouldn't come and share the same stage. So one year, William Lloyd Garrison was the keynote speaker. The next year, it was Frederick Douglass. And it was Harriet Beecher Stowe who kind of brokered a truce between those two giants. So it is a fascinating story.
That Frederick Douglass breaking away and establishing his own persona and independence really goes back into the 1840s when he's in Ireland and Great Britain for a couple of years, and he really sets himself on his own path. So, John, from your perspective as a teacher of literature, American literature particularly, what's your view of this novel? I mean, we've talked about the people who opposed it and the people who love it and all that kind of stuff. What's your view of this novel, and what's critical about it?
The voice, excuse me, Huck's voice, and I think the one way that I use into the book is a poem that wasn't even written at the time the book was, by Paul Laurence Dunbar, called "We Wear the Mask," and that's from the 1890s, just next decade after Huck came out, and I think the book is aware of that Jim is wearing a mask all the way through. He's masked to Huck. Huck occasionally breaks through that mask. There are these moments of contact between them. But from the larger societal perspective, he's still behind the mask. So I think the book, it needs to be taught, but it also needs to be taught, I think, with an understanding of the effect that it can have on students in a class. To hear the N-word frequently, I think you—
Very frequently.
Very frequently you have to talk about that and maybe find a way for reading passages in class that don't include that, but it needs to be read to be seen in the text. But I think you have to be very careful of the students in the class. But at the same time, it reflects a very painful part of our history. And if we overlook that, we're losing some perspective, I think, that we need to have.
What did Twain say about this later in his life? What did he say about the book? I was wondering if, as I understand it, there was a certain amount of pressure on him to write a follow-up to Tom Sawyer, which was lighter, doesn't get to the core of things quite the same way.
He did a couple of those.
Yes. But he finally grapples with this. So what did he think about what he had created?
Well, it's hard to say because his later years were pretty despairing, very pessimistic at time. Family members died.
Letters from the Earth.
Yeah. If you read The Mysterious Stranger, and he also becomes a much more explicit social critic, and we're going to talk about that next month at Beecher Stowe House. So, yes, there it is.
Okay.
the private history of, well, the person sitting in darkness, the United States of Lynchardom, the war prayer, those things. And it led to a – I think when Huck lights out for the territory at the end of the book, you can see that he's just not compatible. The sound heart that he has is not compatible with the deformed society in which he lives. And I think more and more Twain felt that way himself.
Chris, what's your – you and the friends, what's your vision of the long-term role of the Stowe House in this community?
Well, it's to be a beacon, as one of our volunteers who put together the history of the second chapter of the house's life, to be a beacon of cooperation, very similar to the Freedom Center's perseverance, cooperation, courage, the same kind of thing, only in a more intimate setting, because it isn't a recreation of something. It is where all these different themes, women's rights, class rights, racial equality, all those rivers collide right there in Dr. Beecher's living room. So it's the real thing. But we're using it for the same kind of things that you were doing at the Freedom Center.
Okay. Well, first off, I want to thank all three of you. Christina Hartlieb, who's the executive director. It's wonderful to have an executive director finally at the Stowe House. Chris DeSimeo, who can change clothes and change roles so quickly in a two-minute time. And Dr. John Getz, who was a staple at Xavier University for decades. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer of today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website, WVXU.org. I'm Dan Hurley. Stay tuned to 91.7 for Here and Now, coming up next.